640 Toronto presents Think Tank. The breaking stories you care about. Facts and opinions that get you through the day. Now, let's meet the guests.
All right, let's do just that. Ladies first, Stephanie Smythe, who's been in for Alex Pierce in the last couple mornings. Earlier start, faster finish for you on your broadcasting morning this morning. You don't have to go all the way till noon. Not that I'm aware of, anyway.
I'm okay with that. Thank you, and good morning.
We've got Ben Mulrooney, who's back in the chair for Toronto this weekend, 7 to 10 on Saturday, 7 to 10 on Sunday. And you were kind of the Eclipse pregame show on Monday, Ben, I think, to a great extent.
Yeah, I was. Once the show was over, I was able to go outside and enjoy. Can I say it was anticlimactic? I mean, it's just a cloudy day that got dark and then not so dark anymore.
And the Mulrooney family's not one of these families on mass making ophthalmology appointments nonstop because their eyes are hurting. You played it safe.
We played it very, very safe. I was very, very proud of my kids that they stuck to the script.
They've been told, hey, listen, good. You're not allowed to complain about your eyes till at least the fall. We got to get through the spring and summer. Roy Green is the awesome host of the Roy Green Show on the Chorus Radio Network, which airs 2 to 5 on Saturday and Sunday. We love our chats on Friday with Roy. Thanks very much.
Hey, Greg. Thank you very much for asking me. And as far as the eclipse goes, I ran into a little bit of pushback because I said, what's the big deal? We have an eclipse every day. It's called nighttime.
Yeah, I haven't seen all these politicians with weird glasses just staring up at the sunset night after night. I'm like, you guys in your stage photos, it's really something. We saw it on every level of government from every party. You must be outside staring up in wonderment at the sky like you've never seen anything like it before. But it was one of those moments. All right, our first topic, panel today. I think we all have this where were you moment. It's all about this.
We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Nicole Brown Simpson. We, the jury, in the above entitled action, find the defendant Orenthal James Simpson not guilty of the crime of murder in violation of Penal Code Section 187A, a felony upon Ronald Lyle Goldman.
Okay, it's almost that where were you and what did you think question. Let's start with Stephanie Smythe. Beyond the obvious that fashion was a little bit different and a few of us men might have been wearing really, really ill-fitting goatees and wider collars. But take us back to your thoughts and where you were that very moment 29 years ago.
Yeah, at the risk of dating myself also, you should have seen the maternity wear back then because I was on something at a little house in the prairie, but I was on actually a mat leave when the whole slow speed chase happened with a baby on my lap watching it, like not at work, which, and at that time I was at another news radio station in the city of Toronto. And so just watching it transfixed. But as we know, the trial went on for a full year and then mat leaves weren't a year. So eventually I got back to work. And so it was an incredible event that we saw, as everybody has acknowledged, in the time since we learned about O.J.'s passing yesterday. It was just something that transfixed and divided America like none other, right? It was just an incredible time that kept us captivated and changed, everything, the way we cover live news as well in many ways. So it was a moment you don't forget for sure where you were, especially with that slow speed chase and then the glove and the acquittal.
Yeah, Ben, one of those moments in time where I also think we didn't have cell phones. We weren't texting people. We barely had email then. Like, we really either watched that as a group and then had our own internal conversations about not just the entire trial, but obviously that verdict day.
Yeah, I was in the student union building of Duke University. That's where I went to school. So in the South, and you're right. We didn't have our cell phones. So what the school did is they put up televisions all throughout the student union. Such, and African American students congregated around one section, and white students were in another place. The reaction to the verdict in that moment was night and day. So that's what I remember from that moment. From the trial, I remember one thing that my dad told me. He said the dumbest thing that the prosecution did was they forgot one of the most important things that they learned in law school. Don't ask a question that you don't already know the answer to. And so when they pulled out those gloves and they asked them to try them on, That's when it got lost. And the third thing I'll say is the most salient thing I heard about this entire trial ever was not from a journalist. It was from a stand-up comic, Chris Rock, who said this trial was not about race. It was about celebrity, because if OJ had been a bus driver, he wouldn't be OJ. He'd be a rental living murderer.
Yeah, Roy, one of the most dramatic things, and I was trying to think of those "where were you" moments that everybody relates to, 9/11, Princess Diana's car accident. But OJ kind of has too, because I think people remember the Bronco chase that Steph outlined just as much as the verdict 15 months later, don't they?
Absolutely. And Greg, I'll date myself right now. I was in the studio when the verdict came out. I'm trying to remember whether I was in the studio when the verdict came out, or whether we talked about it the next day. But anyway, we had talked about very little else leading up to the eventual jury verdict. And there was, as Ben said, there was a real polarization of opinion about the verdict. I was taking calls, and we were having, first we tried to not screen the calls just to see what people were thinking. And then we realized that's a dangerous thing to do today because emotions were so high. It was very close, 50, maybe 60, 40 people saying, yeah, he was guilty. He should go to prison for life. But a good percentage of our callers really believed that he hadn't done it. And that, I also believe, had a lot to do with his celebrity status. This is the man who ran for 2,003 yards in 1973, right? Some of his NFL rushing records still stand today. It was a celebrity case, and I think justice, unfortunately, took a back seat.
And in the infancy of the internet, Roy, this was somebody everybody, all throughout the 70s, all throughout the 80s, he would have been one of the most recognizable faces. And I think also, Roy, we learned, I'll come back around from Roy, Ben, and Steph, what we learned also is that sometimes, and we see this a lot now, two things can be true and run along parallel lines. I didn't have a doubt after the verdict ended that the police tried to frame O.J. Simpson. I didn't doubt for a second they manufactured evidence, but I also didn't doubt that he did the crimes. And the jury just saw this as payback for many years, saying, you never believe us if there isn't evidence that we've got a problem with this particular police department. The Rodney King verdict was 2 years earlier. This just felt like, a bit of a revenge court situation, Roy.
You know, Greg, sometimes over the last 24 hours, certainly, I've thought about, what would it have been like had social media then been what it is today? What would we have been experiencing as a society? Would it have been a situation where people just debated and argued with each other online? Or would it have been a situation that spun out of control and we might have had riotous realities in the streets? I wonder about that. But really, it was about a spectacular star. That's what he was. Mm-hmm. O.J. Simpson running through an airport. I can still, in my mind's eye, see those commercials. And he was a hero to an entire young generation. And it was difficult to accept that this man, this hero, could have done what I now truly believe he did.
Ben, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because Roy lays that out.
Yeah.
And pre-social media, think of all the conflicts we talk about now that are almost amplified. Polarization, I don't think we're as polarized as social media tells us we are. But get on there for an hour and you feel like civil war is about to break out. O.J. Simpson, you documented that in that student hall, is that people saw it very different ways.
I think we would be rioting in the streets. I absolutely believe that. I heard somebody explain sort of the damage of social media, the problem with it. He said, back in the day when there was no social media, you would hear something that you disagreed with, and then you would go back to your life and you would be socialized with all sorts of other ideas and concepts. And all of that tempered that one thing that you didn't like. But now, because of social media and the funnel and the echo chamber that it is, you hear that one wrong thing that you don't agree with, and then you have 1,000 voices a minute reminding you that you are right and that person is wrong. And that has altered how we think, that has altered how we talk to each other, that has altered how how we form communities. So I absolutely believe that if we had social media today, there would have been riots in the streets.
Steph, I'd also say it not only framed race relations, I think it framed conversations about domestic abuse, because it told us years later that this woman, Nicole Brown, had just been tortured by her ex-husband. Well, she was happily married, so to speak, and certainly after she left, he stalked her, he hit her, he abused her, and the police said, it's O.J. Simpson, what are we supposed to do? And we looked at that and thought, that's not right, that's incredibly wrong.
Right. Well, yeah. And here we are still talking about intimate partner violence, right, to this very day. It's been in the news. Everything, it was just, nobody could reconcile the two things, right, that O.J. was this one celebrity sports star, and then at the same time, potential killer and, you know, abuser, chronic abuser. Like, in getting back to the social media point, well, we know 95 million people watched that slow speed chase. When we watched it, you know, I was looking at some of the video from 30 some years ago, you can see people on overpasses. So with or without social media, the word was getting out. It was an advent of a different kind of live television. People were like heightened, so aware of this. I'm shocked there weren't protests, as a matter of fact, as there were with Rodney King, you know, but it was completely divided. And yesterday, when we talked about it, it was on air for Alex yesterday, when we learned of OJ's death, we went to social media, and it was filled with memes. And basically, I would say overarching is that, you know, a killer is dead, basically was the response on social media yesterday. And bringing up, you know, Norm MacDonald and all the people that made fun of him over the years and everything. So it's really fascinating to see what was going on, that conversation on social media yesterday versus no social media, you know, 30 some years ago.
Very wrong. Very wrong. Norm couldn't outlast him and do a 20-minute stand-up broadcast across the world today. I would point that out. Let's flip this. Ben, I want to start with you here. I think this is interesting. Yeah. I look for wins and losses sometimes, and I'm like, where's the win here in the Premier Doug Ford deciding not to put mandatory electric vehicle chargers in new homes? If this is the way, if you're going to put all these billions of dollars of subsidies in, it's the federal government and the provincial government, and we're all going to be driving at least some modicum of electric cars, make it easier for the consumer. And it's $500 a home. And when we're talking about $1.3 million for the average home in Toronto, I think, what's 500 bucks among friends? I kind of don't get this story why we're not putting these compulsory plugs in houses and garages.
Yeah, and especially because there seems to be a broad consensus that this would be a good idea. I don't think that you would find the Liberals and the NDP or the Green Party telling him it's a bad idea to put them in. So I guess, you know, polling showed that this would be a sort of a winner for them. I don't think you'd make a decision like that without checking the political winds. But I also think that there's nothing wrong with pivoting when the facts on the ground change. The facts on the ground are that sales are lagging. The facts on the ground is we are pumping billions upon billions upon billions of dollars into electric infrastructure, and there is not as much adoption as we would want. So, you know, you could argue that it's a conservative principle that if you want a car, you should pay for the car. If you want that car, that means you have to pay for the infrastructure of it as well, or at least participate in the payment of it. Much like I believe Doug Ford did as soon as he came into office, didn't he remove the provincial subsidy for buying an electric vehicle?
Yeah, absolutely. As soon as he got in 2018.
Yeah, he's like, if you want that car, go buy that car. But we are not going to subsidize you buying a Tesla.
Yeah, Roy, I know you've talked about this and your lack of admiration for a certain Mr. Guilbeault. But at the same time, if we're headed in this direction, we saw Olivia Chow, along with the province's energy manager yesterday, saying we need more energy in Toronto. We need more this. We need more that. Well, of course, like electric vehicles, they're intriguing, but there's been a wave of people that can afford them that were really interested in them. And we're seeing those lagging sales with that second wave where people say it's too expensive and you're not making it worth my while to get one.
Let's begin with the fact that the federal, Ontario, and Quebec governments announced they would subsidize EV battery manufacturing infrastructure for Northvolt, Volkswagen, and Stellantis to the tune of $37.7 billion. The Parliamentary Budget Officer reports the figure is closer to $43.6 billion. The extra $5.8 billion is lost in corporate taxation revenue. So personally, let me grab the inner tube and jump into the deep end. I can't get too excited about the Ford government announcement about rescinding the mandatory installation of EV chargers in new home construction, Greg. And I wonder truly how significant a mandated $500 EV charger would be anyway to home buyers who've struggled so mightily to afford a home in the first place. Yeah, it was ending rebates of $14,000 for EV purchases that Mr. Ford introduced. And I think that would be a far greater issue for potential purchasers. And, you know, just from my perspective, look, EV sales are down. Manufacturers are delaying their production. We got out in front of ourselves on the entire issue of EVs in a tight economic situation where interest rates and inflation are limiting consumer spending options. And we know that EVs are not inexpensive. So no mandatory EV chargers in new Ontario home construction, to me, that's in the B or C column as far as most important considerations for home buyers is concerned.
Steph, it's really tricky. And you're in the city proper. I'm out in the suburbs. And I'm sure every time I drive by a large condo building or even something that is four or five stories, I'm thinking, where are all the chargers going to go? Where's all the power on the grid coming from? Again, the mayor made that point yesterday during that news conference. This isn't going to be an easy push, if you will.
Well, first of all, I just feel disappointment, right? There was excitement for an alternative, right? Another way to work toward, you know, helping environment. You know, but if the bottom line is, and we're seeing it over and over again, it's about what the economy dictates, right? The sales are sagging, partly because of the charging infrastructure, but still, you know, it's expensive. People aren't buying them. So to mandate having charging stations in homes, I mean, at this point, it's a pivot. We're getting used to pivots. And, you know, sometimes in business, you got to pivot. And what makes the most sense right now, sadly, in my estimation, it's not, you know, the EV charging stations at homes. Maybe it'll pivot again. We can only hope.
Yeah. We've got Stephanie Smythe, Ben Mulrooney, Roy Green on Think Tank. A few minutes left on it. So this story has some layers. I'll try and explain it to the audience. But a teacher in York Region has been charged after allegedly sexually assaulting a student enrolled in private music lessons. This has got some layers because this is not believed to have happened to a student at the elementary school, which is called Maple Leaf Public School in Newmarket. But it is significant that this 30-year-old man does not have a license with the Ontario College of Teachers. We've confirmed that. So nothing happened in the school. I'm told by people at the board, a police check, they would have done it. They absolutely wouldn't have missed that. That's priority one, to make sure everybody has a police check. But I'll start with you, Steph. Licensed teachers are accused of these things, too. I just don't know if parents want or maybe even know about the fact we've got unlicensed teachers who never spent a day in teachers' college or never went to school to teach in our schools right now. That's the unions say the labor shortage is so significant. So as egregious as this accusation is and these charges are, I think there's a story here in that this person never went to teachers' college.
Well, I don't think this is necessarily new. Like in the private school system, I think back in the day, not all teachers were necessarily licensed, right? Like, and I'm talking, you know, some well-known private schools in Toronto. So, and with when you have a music teacher come into school to teach in the public system, they were probably music specialists and knew their music, but they weren't probably licensed teachers. But the bottom line is, whether you license them or you don't, you do police background checks or you don't, it's just a matter of the risk that there are going to be predators out there. And, you know, everybody has to beware. But in terms of, you know, whether the issue is the licensing, it's not going to stop this from happening, right? Bottom line.
Ben, I think we want to be confident in our processes for unlicensed teachers, but there is a concern that because of shortages and because it is people are taking more leaves of absence, the concern is using more and more of them. And if you ask a teacher, they'll say, I want to look next to me and know someone's got the same training I do. I think we'd say that in most businesses, in the skilled trades, we'd say it in the military. So it returns, I don't know that we want our education dangling on too many unlicensed teachers like this case for this example, I should say.
Yeah, well, yeah, I agree, and I appreciate everything Stephanie said. That look, this is not an example of the larger the larger system, but it could be a bellwether. Like this is like she said, a piano teacher or a music teacher has a specific skill, and if they're needed, they're brought in, and I have to assume on an ad hoc basis. and it's not the same in every school. And therefore, if it's not the same in every school, then you can't have a system in place, a broad system to do it. You have to let the schools decide how they're going to do it. But you're absolutely right. The numbers are there. We see the iceberg. There is a crisis coming. We have fewer and fewer teachers, and those that we have are burning out earlier, and they're choosing a career change for whatever reason. And yet, if this becomes an alternative to the system, if this becomes how we solve that problem, then that's a problem.
Roy, we got plenty of licensed teachers who've done bad stuff, been accused of bad stuff. We'll see where this case goes. But I talked to one principal yesterday, and he's just worried that human resources, they're stretched so thin, and we're rushing bodies into classrooms for coverage. That has to be a concern across the province and probably the country, too.
I want to follow up on what Stephanie said. The issue, this issue is about the schools and the unlicensed teacher. But the issue is far greater than that, deeper than that. Policies, even laws, are not going to dissuade the most virulent of child sex offenders. They'll attempt to circumvent all policies and laws. They have their vile support networks, and they groom parents in order to attack the parents' kids. The more we remove parents from the supervision of their children's lives and turn over supervision to bureaucracies, including education bureaucracies, the more victims will be created, because the predators know where to attack, i.e. the Roman Catholic Church. The issue is protecting children from assault by supposedly trustworthy adults, and we have not been able to do that. Just think of Larry Nassar, the U.S. National Gymnastics doctor, who sexually assaulted young gymnasts for years before he was interdicted, charged, and sent to prison. The issue is far deeper, and the result that we need is right in front of us. We have to find a way to properly protect our kids and not just take it one case at a time.
Yeah, we got a long list of hockey coaches, Graham James at the top. Absolutely. We could mention as well. Hey, I got to leave it there. Loved having all three of you on. Thanks so much. Have a good weekend. And Roy and Ben, I'll be listening tomorrow. Thanks again.
Bye, guys.
There's Stephanie Smyth, Roy Green, Ben Mulrooney joining us on Think Tank.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone. Like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.